So.
Last night the DJ saved my life.
No truer words were spoken.
Hello guys, today we are talking about a very special heritage, the place which revolutionized nightlife and the creative industry. We all know that nowadays the night economy plays an important role in each city, and it is one of the primary reasons why young people and generally people move to cities. But all that began in Manchester when the first big electronic band started its own club, a club that went beyond classes, gave the start of the rave culture, revolutionized music, and most importantly brought people from different classes and backgrounds together. The Hacienda.
And on that note and theme of the UK, we are drinking a London Root cocktail today, which is gin, is Anne's fave, passion fruit juice, Contro, fresh lime, and some marmalade. Just some marmalade in your cocktail. Do you get much more British than that? So yeah, guys, get your drinks ready, join us, and be prepared to learn something new, because I hadn't heard of the Hacienda prior to this episode, so it's definitely some deep food for thought for what we love the most, which is a party party.
So today we're going to be talking a lot about Manchester music, because that's where the Hacienda is based, and that's kind of the initial super club. Like in the UK, you might hear of like Cream, or which was the basis for Creamfields, which is one of those, the biggest, I think, dance festival in the UK.
Oh my God,
like
I think we have about that in Australia.
Well,
as well.
Creamfields, yeah. It's probably like a full on.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, Creamfields was based, or was based on a club that was inspired by the Hacienda.
Wow.
Well, we need to take you further back.
Yeah, firstly, Manchester, is it the second biggest city in the UK? In England, sorry? After London? Or
no.
What's its vibe?
I think the third. Maybe, but Birmingham's the second.
So okay, so it's, but it's like a pumping scene in England.
Yeah, although it wasn't really then. Back in the 70s, it was a very industrial.
Right, so it's not like how we know it today.
Right.
It's a very working class city.
Yeah. Industrial, working class, lots of factories.
Right.
And that's kind of where our story picks up.
Okay.
That the big music of the 70s, like the disco classics and the big kind of overblown rock music of the time, you know, the Pink Floyd, mm-hmm. or any of the big kind of heavy metal bands, all of that was not seen as relatable to the working class people. Like the working class people of Manchester, or the ones that we're talking about today, they didn't see themselves reflected there. So,
and here we also have economical issues occurring in the UK during that time.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, that had a big impact on it. Unemployment. It was
lots of strikes.
Yeah.
And we have also subsequently the election of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
Oh, Thatcher.
So, yeah. So at the end of the 70s, the Sex Pistols, the iconic punk band, came to perform in Manchester for the first time. And several of our key players went to that gig, and they, for the first time, they saw themselves reflected, because it was very DIY. It was very anti-establishment. It was a bit of a mess, like, because the Sex Pistols were. They were hardly the most polished band in the world. But they finally saw something that spoke to them. And so many people who were at that gig then went on to become massive superstars.
So were they just in the audience watching the Sex Pistols?
Yeah, they were just inspired by that one gig. So we have Tony Wilson. He was a TV presenter and DJ in Manchester, and he was quite big on the TV scene. Also the members of the band of Joy Division, and even like Morrissey from the Smiths and others. I think even Mick Hucknall, who you might not think as being like the most punk person out there, but he was there in the audience that night, and that kind of really influenced his getting involved in music. So Joy Division were a new, young kind of post-punk
a band, indie band, that were working their way up at that time. And they approached Tony Wilson, he was quite a big player in the music scene, because even though he was a TV presenter, he was very well known in the area, and a lot of people who were interested in music would kind of talk to Tony. They approached him and he agreed to be their manager in what was a very iconic exchange, where they signed the contract in blood on the night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jesus, after a few drinks?
Yeah, I believe so. It also said that all of the music was owned by the band and nothing belonged to the record label. And the band had the right to fuck off at any point, owning all of their own.
Wow.
Yeah, that was written in blood on the contract.
Nice, yeah.
But Tony believed it.
And you see that such approach is defining for the Hacienda and the whole culture around it.
Okay. So they started Factory Records from that exchange. And Tony went on to sign a few more bands over the years. And yeah, they really kept to that very...
idealistic approach.
Yeah, yeah.
Naive approach.
Naive. Yeah. left-wing.
Yeah.
Owned by the people, for the people. So he signed the bands of Joy Division, A Certain Ratio, Dorothy Column, later on the Happy Mondays, briefly James, and OMD as well. So he had quite a good roster at various points. And I say he, but really they just all owned themselves. Like, they really own anything. Yeah. And with Alan Erasmus, who was a band manager and actor also on the Manchester scene, they started a DJ and band night at the Russell Club. It was just one night a week where the bands would turn up to play or the DJs would play. But again, it was kind of the only night in Manchester that reflected that type of music scene, where they could play the music that appealed to them. And that's where it all started.
Yeah. And then we have the... by the way, as you mentioned, Joy Division, Ian Curtis, amazing lyricist.
Yes.
And, and unfortunately, he passed away very young.
Yeah.
Bit of a tragedy.
He very sadly committed suicide right as Joy Division were taking off as a band. But the band didn't stop there. They decided to reform and keep going, and they became... New Order.
To be honest, I think that's one of the greatest transformations.
Definitely in musical history, as far as I can think of. You know, you think of a lot of artists starting off as a band and becoming a solo career, but you very rarely hear of a band losing its lead singer and reforming and carrying on.
And such a lead singer.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was so iconic.
Yeah, like, yeah.
A lot of people... watched the band for his charisma.
Yeah.
Right.
So for them to decide to carry on anyway was...
Yeah.
Actually, I love New Order. Like, they were one of my favorite bands.
And the interesting thing is you see their transition, how through the years they start to embrace more and more technology and this electronic sound.
Yeah.
And that they're good at it. They're really good in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. They're one of the first bands... to really embrace the technology that's available. Like, that's what made them different, and that's what changed them from being this indie act to a major dance act.
Basically, guys, if you haven't listened to New Order, their most famous song is Blue Monday.
Oh, you know it. You so know it.
Yeah.
I, as, like, someone not really involved in the early techno scene, know this song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
And the story around Blue Monday is also particularly funny.
It was the biggest hit of the year.
The biggest hit of the year, yeah.
And
it's the most sold dance song ever, right?
Yeah, I think the biggest, was it 12-inch or 8-inch? I can't remember which one. But yeah, but they actually lost money on it.
Yeah, they never made a profit on it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the reason was that producing the vinyl was more expensive than the price for which they were selling it.
Wow.
Because they decided to go the artistic route
and
do some like special, some like a laser cut to make it look like a floppy disk, like super 80s for the technology of the time. And because the laser cutting was so expensive, they lost money on every copy sold.
But like, can I just say, like, I remember as like a young 15, 14 year old, just into kind of electro music, I bought the Ministry of Sound in... maybe the Ministry of Sound album, sorry, which I should say was just like this kind of yearly annual track of the kind of hyped techno music of the time. And that song was on it in like literally like 2009, 2008 kind mm-hmm. of vibe. And yeah. lest we forget, the first time I went out with you guys, one of the first times was at a karaoke club
yeah.
and you guys singing
that song.
New Order's Blue yeah. Monday.
Yeah.
And which I'm like, is a terrible karaoke choice.
It's,
yeah,
it's not yeah, like yeah. a 50-minute intro. Yeah. Like,
and it's all very monotone. Like yeah. there's no tune to yeah. it. So it was just us.
How does it feel?
Exactly. It was like, us being very monotone the whole time. It was like, this was a bad
so
choice.
Good. Yeah. yeah. So it's friggin' iconic is what yeah. I want to say.
Yeah. Definitely. Oh, but good fact about Blue Monday is that it wasn't even meant to be a single to start off with. Oh. The band actually were they didn't do encores, and people always complained that they didn't do encores. So they basically made an electronic loop that they could leave the stage to it that would just keep playing after they'd left the stage. So it was like, it was just basically a looped soundtrack that they could wander off and have a pint and the music would carry on without them. And that's how Blue Monday started, and it became the biggest selling 12-inch of all yeah. time. Like, yeah. And there's another story to go with this, like in terms of design. Much like the record sleeves, the Hacienda itself went massively over budget on design, and that meant it didn't get as good a deal with the breweries as it should have done, because they basically were running at a loss because of the design, and that meant that the club was always running at a loss. Like, from the very opening, it never made any money.
Oh my god.
They also made yeah. some rookie mistakes, like being open 7 nights a week. Like, no one's gonna go to your club like on a random Tuesday for no reason. They said sometimes they opened it and it'd be like 10 students yeah. and that'd be it.
So
yeah.
so in 1984 the Hacienda got a problem with the tax office.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, in Spanish, the tax office is called La Hacienda.
Oh, is it? Oh, really?
So, yeah. So, and it looked like the club was close to a bankruptcy. And Peter Hook says that New Order still holds the record for biggest tax fine of any English group. Basically, the Hacienda was losing £15,000 per month, which in the 80s was a huge amount of money.
And tax authorities...
And that was after Blue Monday.
Yeah, tax authorities thought that there's no way that the band are putting that amount of money into the club. Like, they thought it was basically a money laundering scam. And the money was all going on, I don't know, drugs or something. And it wasn't. They literally were putting all of their earnings back into the club because they owned it along with Tony Wilson, like Factory Records, all of them. They owned it together. So... Yeah.
But then the big shift happened after the mid-80s when Acid House became a big part of the Hacienda.
Yeah.
And the Ecstasy explosion happened. And yeah, each of the main actors says that Ibiza was quite influential.
Oh, yeah.
For the present of this yeah. Acid House.
And like Ibiza to this day is like a party island, and it still very much holds that legacy. But yeah, we can't forget Spain's role in bringing the club to the forefront. And like you said, Ibiza was an island in particular that after the 80s, after the fall of Franco, after the fascist regime, Ibiza's tourism boomed, and that became the biggest source of their international income. So suddenly, British people had access to the Mediterranean, because not only was it open, firstly, from Spain's perspective, but flights weren't available only to the elite. Like, suddenly the everyday person, okay, not like we know it today, but there was an openness to its accessibility.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Suddenly affordable.
Suddenly affordable, people. Yeah. And it's, even if you weren't, didn't have a lot of money, you could still go there, not ball out, spend a ton, but you still had the opportunity to be exposed to what was happening on Ibiza. Yeah.
It's important to mention that there was also this window of several years where during the transition period from the fascist regime of Franco into the democratic one, there was this window where the Spanish government didn't really regulate nightlife, and the use of drugs. And this helped for the development of a very creative industry in Ibiza and a great nightlife.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
But yeah, it really influenced the music scene in the UK because Paul Oakenfold and friends brought it over after they had a night at Amnesia. And yeah, a lot of them went on to make their own super clubs in the UK, which were largely inspired by the Hacienda. The Hacienda kind of started the movement. And then as Acid House developed, like inspired by the Chicago house music and techno music of the time, it then kind of morphed into this whole new creature that was then reinvented in super clubs in London, like Cream, Ministry of Sound, Gatecrasher. Yeah, there were loads of them, basically. And they were doing this new thing where rather than listening to one type of music only, like going to a blues night or a rock night or a disco night, now it was all kind of happening together at the same time. Yeah. And that was something really different, bringing together different types of people from different backgrounds.
Yeah. And this again lasted, as everything in life just lasted for a few good years. And by the beginning of the 90s, there were some serious problems with Hacienda happening.
Yeah.
I read that, by the way, in 1989, they were already then trying to speak with the police that they need to put a policeman on the doors of the Hacienda because many people were entering who were selling drugs there and gangs were entering. Yeah, we have to say also in the beginning that Acid House also gave the start of the rave parties. And I read stories where hooligans of West Ham and Miwo were dancing together and celebrating live together. Like, it was this feeling of the 60s returning to England, you know?
Fueled by ecstasy.
Yeah, fueled by ecstasy, yeah. Yeah. But then, as always, it went mainstream and it became a victim of itself. And basically they say that the beginning of the end was around 92, 93.
Yeah, because after 91, the Summer of Love, where there had been all of the illegal raves across the UK, which were inspired by the music that was originating from the Hacienda and then the other clubs. So it was kind of going from there out into the fields, but they were completely illegal. And the government, Thatcher's government, really cracked down hard on those. And the police were monitoring them really, really, like, harshly. And so people discovered that they couldn't carry on doing this. Like, there was just no way that they could carry on because they were being arrested in their thousands. People were being beaten. It just wasn't worth it. Oh, and massive fines for the promoters as well, like huge fines.
Yeah.
So they went back to the clubs. But the problem was in the fields, the kind of drug culture had really spiraled. And so when it came back to the clubs, not only did the drug culture come back, but also the drug dealers came back. And with drug dealers, you get competitive kind of
gangs.
You have weapons in the club.
Like bringing guns into the club.
And also we should mention that when people take ecstasy and they don't drink alcohol, they drink water. So imagine all this ambiguous business plan about that club. They were not selling alcohol.
No one was buying the alcohol. And what's worse, Rob Breton, the manager of New Order, who was also an owner of the club, thought it was too bourgeoisie to sell bottled water. So they didn't sell any of their own water. And one of the bar staff started her own business selling independently from the bar. Like, she was in the club at the bar selling her own bottles of bottled water. No, she was making a fortune.
Yeah.
And the club was making nothing because no one was buying any drinks.
I also read that Peter Hook, who's also, remember, one of the owners of this club, he had to relieve himself in a bucket of mayonnaise because
what?
Yes, because they didn't have enough toilets.
Oh my God. Wow.
Like,
imagine.
And in the same time, this is one of the most influential clubs ever. Like, it changed the nightlife scene in the world, and in the same time, it's just so genuine, and there is total lack of preparation and business management.
Oh, so
So yeah, once the gun culture got out of control and the police weren't willing to step in and help, then it only became a matter of time before things really spiraled. One of the main factors of this was the fact that the club couldn't keep door staff because the door staff quit when there were guns everywhere. And so they ended up hiring one of the gangs to be their door staff. But obviously they were extortionate.
Yeah.
And so basically the gangs were almost as in charge of the club as they were.
Yeah.
At that point, most of the members of New Order cashed in their, well, they didn't get any money back. They just threw their shares at the others and ran away. Yeah. Well, and who can blame them?
Should we also mention Happy Mondays, which was a band that originated from the Hacienda, and it's defining for the success of the Hacienda. Well, if you look at the videos of Happy Mondays, you would see a random guy called Bez, whose sole function was to dance.
Yeah, Bez is a national icon.
Yeah.
or he was in the 90s.
And he was a pretty bad dancer, you know, and they were paying him money. He's always there with them dancing and being an important part of the band.
He was the band.
Oh, the band.
Yeah.
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 So like there was like the lead singer, then the members of the band, and there was Bez on the stage with them. Like basically their mate who they got up to dance, like to get the crowd going.
Oh,
and there's lots of arm movements, there's lots of high knees. Yes. But yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. But overall, we should say that the Hacienda in this movement in Manchester was so impactful that it went to other regions in the world. A very good example is Spain and Valencia, where we have the La Ruta de Bacalao, which was again several clubs near Valencia, where acid house, progressive music, and the creative industry got together and created an amazing time for young people from the 80s until mid 90s. However, also there in the same time period after 91, 92, it became a victim of itself. It became too mainstream. The quality of music went down. A good example for how low the quality of music went, guys. you have to check Chimo Bayo, Así Me Gusta A Mí. Where he basically sings Ecstasy, Extano.
Great pun.
Do you totally get it in the beginning? Because you're like, Ecstasy. And then he's like, Extano. And you're like, what are you saying? And it's like, oh my God, Spanish.
Yeah, Spanish.
Spanish.
Sí.
And no.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So yeah, it's one of the most influential things in terms of music, the Hacienda. And we should remember that no one changed the world being normal.
Yeah.
And the Hacienda, New Order, Tony Wilson, they definitely changed the world.
Yeah. Yeah, because they were a live music band who played electronic music. They were pretty much the first in the world to do that.
They changed the game.
Yeah.
They really did.
The place where rave music was born.
Wow.
And
so relevant today.
And yeah, when people talk about the Hacienda, they still remember it very fondly, and they still have views of how they see it, how they remember it, and how they want it to kind of stay as a memory. One of the former DJs, Kath McDermott, said that apart from the fact that it was a great building and sad to see that go, but glad that nobody could reopen it as a heritage oddity or something today. So yeah, it's interesting that people want to keep it as a memory and keep it as it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it can't kind of be spoiled by modern
modification.
Yeah, like commercialism, because that's the anti-Hacienda.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Never do anything to be commercial.
Yeah.
Can I ask something? Mm-hmm. Did they ever make money?
No.
Oh, no. No. Never. No. No.
They literally never made money.
They were losing £10,000 a month, literally.
And to be honest with you, I don't think they're even rich now.
No, they lost all their money to the tax man.
Oh. Yeah.
For years, they had to pay off the tax because of their accidental not filing their
some
tax
of the biggest some of the biggest bands ever.
Yeah. That's why they're still touring. Crazy. They're still going now. Yeah. Order. And Peter Hook and the Light, because they no longer are on speaking terms, sad times. But they're still touring now.
Wow.
Not necessarily because they need the money, but probably because they need the money.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Wow.
There was actually a quote that I watched a mini documentary, and Bernard Sumner, the lead singer, he said that he was paying for the hacienda this amount of money, like pouring tens of thousands into it, and he was still living in a council house.
Mm.
Wow.
Like, he wasn't living in a mansion with a pool. He was still living in a crummy council house in Manchester.
Yeah.
So...
Well, yeah.
It's all about the ideal, guys. Living the dream.
Yes.
Yeah, live your yes. dream. Yeah.
The ideal.
No, I love it. As Tony Wilson says, fuck Ibiza, you know? Like, I like this punk attitude. Like,
he's a bit of a character, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
So thank you for listening, guys. I hope I don't even know if you will have learned something. We just thought this was interesting.
Hey, I learned something. I appreciate the culture and heritage behind my rave life and dance life. So thanks, guys, for listening to another one of our episodes. Hope you enjoyed. And if you want to get in touch with us or even follow us on our social media, we are at Museums Mojito or with the podcast name on Facebook. Hope next time you're at the club or the rave or the bush doof, you have the hacienda, an idea of the hacienda, and know where this culture came from. And although it's apartments now.
Yeah.
Is there any, like, heritage
club? It's just called the Hacienda Flats. Oh,
the Hacienda Flats.
Because they sold the name. Oh, yeah. Sold the rights to the name.
Yeah.
Well, let it live on.
Let it live on, yeah. Bye, guys.
Bye.